Niech mu gwiazda pomyślności i dnie zagaśnie.
Hi, and happy birthday, if you happen to be Polish, and of course, if it happens to be your birthday. Don't worry if that doesn't include you, though. Should you ever visit Poland, I can promise you that the Poles will treat you so well that you feel like at home, or something like that. Cartoon Queen Carol Hills is here to talk about that and many other language stories culled from the news and borrowed from the blogosphere, so listen on.
Hey, Patrick.
Hi, Carol. It's been a really long time since you've been on the pod.
It has. It's been very long.
I know. We just get all too busy these days. It's really too bad.
And there's a lot happening out there in lingo land.
Oh, there most certainly is. In fact, there is so much happening that we don't have five stories today. We have six.
Ooh.
Yeah, but although I must admit, we have something of a false two. The soccer teams play with a false number nine now.
That's right.
Yeah, so we have a false number two.
Okay.
All right. So number six, it's Chinese menu items. And the Chinese have decided that this is a sort of latest in their cleaning up mistranslation campaigns. They did a whole bunch around Beijing Olympics. And now, in fact, they've got a name for this. It's rather good. Linguistic rectification campaign.
I picture somebody out in a hut with a little red book that's full of menu items instead of Mao quotations.
This particular linguistic rectification campaign is actually by suggestion only.
It contains recommended translations for more than 2,000 of China's most popular dishes.
That's a reporter on Chinese state TV. And if restaurants do adopt these suggested changes, this is for the English menus that many of them offer, it's going to make things easier for foreign visitors,
yes.
People like you and me, but also maybe less fun, less terrifying, certainly. and in fact, on the big show, we called up tour operator Joe Sinisi. He's based in Colorado, I think. And he had some favorite selections from the English menu at the Beijing restaurant.
Let's hear those.
Okay, so we have chafing dish harebelly, Hunan sauteed bullfrog in sauce deep and clean, fish head bubble cake, fresh flower spice plant fertilizer cattle, smooth liver is pounded, and two of my favorites, Mountain City saliva chicken and nine curve fertilizing intestines.
And here's the thing is that Sinisi says that we should not blame this on web-based translation. We might assume that it's that, but it's not, he says.
Well, China has a very rich cuisine and a lot of regional cuisines, and they have names that make sense to them, just like in English, like chicken fried steak might not translate very well. Their translations actually make sense. So if you look at what you'll commonly see, the saliva chicken, the name of the dish is Ko Shui Ji, which literally means a mouthwater chicken. So they're trying to say it's so delicious, it makes your mouth water. Unfortunately, in English, the translation saliva makes you think someone in the back of the kitchen was spitting in your food.
Get your saliva chicken while you can.
Yeah,
get your... It's going to turn mouth-watering any second now.
Get your gross noodle while you can, your husband and wife lung. I also saw, just at the same time, on the Language Log blog, there was a very nice post from Victor Mayer, who often posts on Chinglish items, that somebody had sent him a menu item translated into English from a restaurant in China. And the item in question is translated as the car hit cheese bacon mushroom face, which sounds just crazy.
But what is it?
Well, they didn't actually do that badly. It's a Western item, so it's got bacon, mushroom, cheddar cheese, and pasta, probably spaghetti. They only got the beginning and the end actually wrong, but they got it seriously, seriously wrong. So the first two characters of the Chinese before it's rendered into this nonsensical English are, it's the Chinese version of the word for cheddar, chuda.
Oh.
And unfortunately, the characters in question, the first one, chu, does mean car, and da does mean hit. So when they say the car hit cheese bacon mushroom face,
they just mean cheddar.
They mean bacon, cheddar cheese, rather mushroom. Than yeah, right. And then face at the end is there are two characters. There were originally two characters in traditional characters for one meaning face, one meaning noodles. which was the one they wanted, but they got collapsed into just one character when the characters were simplified.
Aha, uh-huh. And so this, it went to face.
Yeah, well, this translator picked the wrong one. I mean, I suppose it was a 50-50 option, went for face.
And has he been sent to linguistic rectification camp?
That's a very good point. I wonder if linguistic rectification camp, as you put it, if that actually extends to... I mean, the great irony here is this is a Western dish that has been translated from Chinese into...
He had a reprieve for that.
Yeah, maybe he's been spared rectification camp. But I can tell you that maybe there are some Americans who might be sent to whatever the Poconos version of the linguistic rectification camp is. Because in the New York subway around Chinatown, and maybe in some other parts of the subway system, there are bilingual signs. This is a genuine, good-hearted attempt. Absolutely, to make sure that Chinese speakers who don't understand English do understand the signs. Unfortunately, some of the signs are wrong. I tweeted this article and I heard back from one person who said that they're not all as wrong as the article suggested. But nonetheless, there are people quoted in here who have got much better Chinese than you or I, who are outraged at the number of mistranslated signs. And of course, there are an increasing number of hotels and restaurants that cater to Chinese tourists. And as that increases, the menus and various other written messages will be rendered into Chinese, and presumably with that will come more mistakes.
More subjects for our podcast.
And, you know, more fun.
That's right.
And you have story number 5, Carol.
I do, and it's about math, specifically terms used in math. Math, not my strong suit.
Not so, mine either. We're journalists. We're innumerate.
I'm going to be sent to, you know, math rectification camp.
It's going to be a theme of the pod, isn't it?
So the language issue here is words used in math. And the terms that certainly I grew up with when I learned math are different. And I'm learning that not just from reading about this for this podcast, but I have 2 children, 7 and 11. And they bring home their homework, and there's always letters home and unit summaries. And I don't really know what they're talking about most of the time. So terms that I grew up with, like borrowing as opposed to regrouping.
Which are you?
So if you're subtracting, say, 20 minus 8, you can't, the first thing you do is you can't do 0 minus 8. You have to borrow from tens place.
Right.
So you have, you know, 10 minus 8 is 2, and then you have only 1 left, so that's 12. So 20 minus 8 is 12. Well, you used to borrow from that tens place.
Yes.
Now you regroup. Let's regroup, everybody.
They're trying to get the bank references out or something.
Or decompose. But that's
decompose,
just weird. There's nothing...
No. No, you can't, how can math, how can figures decompose?
I know. They do on Wall Street, but that's a different story. Anyway, you know, reduced fractions are now simplified or equivalent fractions. A diamond, a shape, geometric shape is now a rhombus. Squares don't have corners, they have vertices. So the idea is to use words that actually make sense and are mathematically correct, which is laudable. So a bunch of states have adopted these standards and these ideas, and the idea is to be technically proper, but it doesn't necessarily jive with colloquially understandable.
Right. So, that's interesting. Is it part of an attempt to raise standards
to some foreign countries that
already use more technical language?
Absolutely. So many states have bought in, a few haven't. But in the meantime, there's a generation gap in terms of parents understanding what their kids are learning.
Right.
It's not insurmountable by any means.
Right.
But it's just an interesting thing because so much of education is about making things accessible. But in math, I think correctly, frankly, they're trying to make it accurate and true to what it is. But that said, my own kids' math program that they use these mathematically correct terms, but they also have these other made-up vocabulary terms that then makes me all confused. They just like, you know, addition group, or they just make up fake names to describe groups of things or an idea. So in the case of my school district, anyway, they kind of are doing both. But there is this big push to improve math in the U.S.
Well, yeah, I suppose when we were going through, Martha, we were part of the kind of slide toward mediocrity. And it's kind of troughed, maybe, or the hope is that it's troughed, and people will improve partly as a result of this new language.
Yes.
I do hope that that's the case and things don't further decompose.
I know. No more decomposing.
No more decomposing. Okay, well, story number four is a little bit topical, taking place right now in Eastern Europe, the European Soccer Championship, something that's very close to my heart.
I know.
I do enjoy watching those soccer games. But there are some interesting linguistic bits and bobs around it that are worth calling attention to, I think. The first thing is a rather unfortunate slogan that Poland, which is one of the co-hosts along with Ukraine, Poland came up with for its posters that are plastered all over the country. And I think they're aimed mainly at foreign visitors to extend a kind of a welcome to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the slogan is this, it's in English, feel like at home. And if there's anything that makes me not feel like at home, maybe it's an expression like feel like at home.
Does it come out better in Polish?
Who knows? It's just an odd thing. You're going to do something, I mean, this is not without some money behind it.
Yes.
And it's a completely different thing from a mom and pop Chinese restaurant doing translations.
You've got a whole nation.
Yeah. Plus a highly educated, large number of English speakers. I mean, it just seems odd. But I'm sure everybody does feel like at home because Poland's, I've been to Poland. It's a lovely place. And I'm very fond of all of the Polish people I met. So I did, in fact, feel like at home when I was there. And the BBC has offered, I think, what is a very useful thing. They have a pronunciation unit at the BBC, which helps us out from time to time. Sometimes it hinders us a little bit because we're this weird hybrid program, or the big show is, of being half
US. We pride ourselves on being a mongrel. Really.
We are very mongrel-like and broadcast primarily in the United States, but being a BBC co-production, we sort of have access to all of these BBC services, like this pronunciation unit, but occasionally BBC pronunciation is very much UK and doesn't make an awful lot of sense in the US. I don't think that's the case here, and they go into quite a bit of detail in this guide that they have put out around the European Championships. They sort of justify why they are offering certain pronunciations. For example, the name Warsaw, the capital of Poland, they make it clear that, as a rule, if there is an English version of the city, they will go with the English version of the city and not call it Warszawa. I think that's what the polls say.
Really?
Yeah. I think with the smaller the town gets, the more likely it is to have the local pronunciation, which is where the likes of you and I get into trouble. So you have the second city of Poland, Krakow, which is sometimes referred to in this country as Krakow.
Yeah, right? I know it as Krakow.
So I think that might be an anglicization of
it.
But the Poles would say, I think they would say something more like Krakow, Krakow, Krakow. Oh. But I've heard a lot of people on the BBC say Krakow. So they're sort of halfway between the two. And then there's this place that I've never had a clue how to pronounce. I'll just spell it for you. Wroclaw.
Mm.
So if you
were
just
a lot of vowels in that word.
Rocklaw. But anyway, it is pronounced sort of like this. Wrocław. Wrocław. Although you can also say, according to this guide, you can say Wrocław, 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 Wrocław. I think the L and the W in Polish must be quite
depending
similar.
Depending on how many drinks you've had, you can have Wrocław.
That's generally true of most Slavic places. Isn't it? And then there's Gdańsk or Gdańsk. Some people say Gdańsk.
Really?
Yes.
I was always a Gdańsk person myself.
Yeah. And then some people just say Dansk, and they just lose the G.
Completely. They've had it with the G. They're just going Dansk.
And the Bieber sort of, again, describes all of this, and I think they prefer Gdansk, but they'll accept the
others.
And if
you really want to make them mad, you say Danzig.
Or if you want to make the Germans happy or nostalgic or something like that. But yes, if you did say that, maybe you would be sent off to pronunciation rectification weekend or longer. They also go into some of the Ukrainian cities, Kiev versus Kyiv and things like that.
Kyiv?
Kyiv, yeah.
You can pronounce it Kyiv?
They say you can get away with that. I think that's closer to what the Ukrainians say.
I guess you can get away with it. If they're desperate for tourists, they're not going to, like, yell at you. But
no, I think they're more likely to like you if you say Kyiv.
Really?
Yeah, I think Kiev is an anglicization.
Wow,
yeah.
I never knew that.
But I may be completely wrong because I don't speak a word of Ukrainian and two words of Russian. And I wouldn't be able to tell you if Kyiv or any of the other pronunciations that the BBC offers is actually closer to Ukrainian or closer to Russian, these being the two languages of Ukraine.
And this is where things get sticky.
This is where things get sticky because at the moment, Ukrainian is being sort of championed over Russian ever since a little bit after the Orange Revolution. But now, with a pro-Kremlin government having taken over a year or two ago, there is a bill before the Ukrainian parliament that would give Russian official status alongside Ukrainian. Ukrainians say this is completely unfair, or Ukrainian speakers say this is unfair because Ukrainian, as a minority language for hundreds of years, needs protecting against this sort of colonial beast.
Forgive my ignorance, but how similar or different are the two languages? I have no idea.
Well, we dealt with that in a previous podcast, and I can't quite remember.
Okay, listeners, just go and search on the blog, and you'll find the other one.
That's right, right. I'll post a link or two to stuff we've done in the past on the difference between Ukrainian and Russian and on this particular issue, and move along while my head is still above water. Just one more thing on the BBC pronunciations. There's some great names of players in this tournament. Pavel Pogrebniak. He's Russian.
How do they cheer for him? Go, Pavel Pogrebniak!
And then there's the Greek fellow called Panayiotis Kone.
The poor guy who was managing the scoreboard. And it was, you know, for TV coverage. Who just got the kick? Oh, boy, it's tough.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. I there were sighs of relief all over after the Polish goalkeeper, Wojciech Szczesny, was red-carded after the first game, which automatically meant that he was going to miss a game or two afterwards. So they wouldn't have to pronounce his name. But anyway, there you go. All the names and how to perhaps not pronounce them very well at the European Soccer Championship. And story number three is yours, Carol.
Story number three is about not actual words, but punctuation marks. Quotation marks, in fact. Do they qualify as punctuation? They do. We'll just assume it is a punctuation mark. You know what's interesting?
Somebody can always set us right.
Send us
angry email or tweet.
Using some Polish words.
You just won't stand for it anymore. These two people doing a language blog have got no idea about this.
Well, did you know that at one time in history, quotation marks served a single purpose? They were used for quoting people. That's it. Well, that's what the person who runs the blog of unnecessary quotation marks says.
Right. This is the blog that is actually in quotation marks. It goes open quote blog, close quote.
Her name is Bethany Keeley, and she has a whole book called The Book of Unnecessary Quotation Marks, A Celebration of Creative Punctuation. And on the cover of the book, there's a picture of a sign, and the sign reads, it's this handwritten sign. It says, fresh brown eggs. And eggs is in quotation marks.
That just makes you think that they're not eggs at all. I mean, there is that widely used, you know, ironic use of quotation marks to where anything inside the quotation mark is a stand-in for for the word itself.
So it's really fun. Okay, this is a great pastime. You go to her blog and you scan all the photos that people have sent in of funny signs. It's kind of a variation on the Chinese menu. So here's some examples of them. Okay, somebody sent in a photo. It's a handwritten sign on a dishwasher. It reads, broken, please wash your dishes by hand. And by hand is in quotation marks. There's another one, a handwritten sign in a store. Please keep children with you at all times. Children is in quotation marks.
That shows what they think of them. Huh?
Here's a label. This is a label, a produced label for a jar of tomato sauce. It looks like one of those artisanal, you know, homemade things.
Yeah.
But the label is not handmade. It was produced. It says, tomato sauce, and tomato is in quotation marks.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. One that I liked and was at one of those restaurants, I'm not sure if it's the famous one in Philadelphia, where they demand that you order in English only. But anyway, at the counter here, it says, "This is America. When ordering, open quotation marks, speak English, close quotation marks."
There's one sign. It's in a co-op store somewhere. Mm. And again, it's not a handwritten thing. It just is like a banner. And it says, "The Mid-Counties Cooperative does it again." Does is in quotation marks.
No, that's just plain bizarre. That's really odd. I mean, usually they're sort of drawing attention to a word, right, by putting in quotation marks. I think, right?
It's usually not a verb.
Right, it's not a verb. And it's not a kind of dull verb like
right.
does.
Yeah.
That's really strange. But I have to say, this whole thing, I mean, I feel just a little bit guilty because I feel we're kind of just laughing at people's misuse of punctuation here. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the other part of me says, well, it's much, much better to be amused and and as Bethany Keeley says, to celebrate this than it is to get all, you know,
yeah.
hot under the collar and start writing letters to the editor and
yeah.
just getting all outraged and stuff. I mean, what's the point of that? So yeah, this is great. I mean, here's another really just fantastic one. It's actually a tribute to U.S. troops abroad. Mm-hmm. And it says, "Thank, quotation marks, God, close quotation marks, for all the troops from the American family." Covers every deity, I suppose, and more beyond. I mean, maybe non-deities as well.
Here's another one, a sign in a restaurant. Again, this is not a handwritten sign. This is a sign that is in the restaurant. "When you celebrate your special day with us and a friend, we will treat you to a free meal." A meal is in quotation marks. Free meal. What does that mean? And there's another one, another sign. It's, I think it was in an office. "Please open door slowly." Slowly is in quotation marks. See, if I read that, I would slam the door.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it goes on and on. But I'm with you. I mean, you have to have fun with this. It's like bad puns or something. I don't know. They're just, yeah. You have to have fun with it. You can't get all upset. It's just the way language is ever-changing.
Ever-changing. I mean, what's great about this, too, is that it's so good that there are, you know, blogs and books about all of this. Because unlike, quote, bad English that then finds its way into the dictionary because it's used so widely, this is very idiosyncratic. This is, I mean, you're putting meal or something inside a quotation mark. It's the only sign that's doing it. And so it's not like this is there's some sort of groundswell of usage that the dictionary people are going to look at and say, oh, we need that in. That's great.
Well, so, you know, we're just having fun with number three, quotation marks. It's just kind of, I'm laughing with you, not laughing at you.
There you go. All right. Okay, so now it's number two. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, this is the false number two.
It's number two
in quotation marks. It's number two in quotation marks. Of course it is. This is something that I've been wondering how to talk about for some time, because this comes directly out of my gathering language stories, or making sure I see as many language stories as possible every day. So I have, as many people do, have certain feeds on Google News that I subscribe to that I think nearly always, you know, word or phrase based, so mm-hmm. that they will kick up stories that mention those words or phrases. And one of them is a language one that includes words like grammar and spelling. I'm not particularly interested in either grammar or spelling, but they come up nonetheless.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of stories about things to do with language, grammar, spelling. Now, if the word spelling is included, that means that every single story that is out there that is,
I think I know where you're going.
Tory,
yes.
Spelling.
No, no.
So I must admit, before I signed up to this service, I didn't know who Tory Spelling was.
You do now.
Well, I sort of do now. What I know is I know the top two lines of every story, because unless you click on the story, that's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there's only been one story I have ever clicked on, which we'll get to. So I know that Tory Spelling quote marks here, got pregnant too soon. That's the quote from her mother, Candy. I know also that Tori Spelling wonders if cartoons, here's one for you, Carol, if cartoons are getting too smart.
Ooh. Smart in quotation marks. Ooh,
I also know that Tori Spelling tops the weird habits of celebrity moms because of her recent revelation that her husband finds her sexy when she is pregnant, coupled with a recent photograph of her flaunting her baby bump.
So this
is what I get. This is what I get. And then I also know that the 90210 stars, and therefore I realized that Tori Spelling was in 90210, they're still not speaking to each other.
After all these years,
they're still not speaking to each other. Now, here is the story that I finally opened up and read. Well, not all the way through, but it actually has something to do with language. Finally, Tori Spelling blogs about daughter Hattie's first word.
Ooh.
Yes, I couldn't believe it when I saw that.
Here.
I hit the jackpot. That's why I'm talking about this today. So you had to tell me what you think the first word was.
Mine.
That's a good one. But my clue was...
Money? Buy it.
Buy it. That's right. Versace. It was not Mama. And Tori was disappointed by that. That's the main thrust of the story, was that it was not Mama.
Uh-huh.
And she was upset. It was Dada.
Oh.
And then this is a story with substance because it cites a, unlike this podcast, it cites a 2008 study that explained why both Mama and Dada are common first words.
Well, because it's Mama and Dada that's been saying, I'm Mama, I'm Dada.
It's one of those studies.
They hear it a lot.
You don't really need. But there was another survey in 2011 that found a majority of babies say Dada rather than Mama. 52% say Dada, 35% say Mama.
My kids, I think, you know, actually my daughter's first word was mine.
Oh, really? Mine was ball. Really? I mean, my daughter's was ball.
For soccer ball.
Yeah.
And I think for my son, it was Daddy, Dada. Mm. I don't know. I took it personally for like about 20 seconds. That was fine. He moved on.
Maybe you should talk to Tori about it. She's been blogging. So there we are. False number two. On to story number one.
Okay. Real number one. This is kind of a cool story. It moves to more scholarly kinds of publications. And it's about biodiversity and language. What a study has found is that, and this isn't like a study by Tori Spelling, it's a study by real academics. What they found is that biodiversity hotspots, both those that are rich in flora and fauna and protected, and those rich in flora and fauna which are under threat, both kinds of hotspots are flush with languages, and a huge number of the world's languages exist in these places.
Mm.
So you think,
So are the places where the flora and fauna are threatened also the places where the languages are under threat?
Both.
But is there a correlation between places where they're thriving?
Where they're thriving, there's lots of languages, and where they're under threat, there's lots of languages. Both kinds.
Yeah.
And at first I read this, I went, wow, well, gee, I mean, that's incredible. So a couple of the hot spots, Tanzania, you know, we think of it, you know, wildlife safaris and stuff like that. 130 plus languages in that one country.
Wow.
An Indo-Burma hotspot, 400 languages.
Indo-Burma?
What's Indo-Burma? I think it's a hotspot around India and Burma, shared area. That's what I think, but I'm on this podcast, so I'm not being authoritative. Okay, listen to this. Vanuatu, an island in the Pacific, 100-plus languages.
Really?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
So again, what we're talking about is a lot of them are languages spoken by a handful of people.
Mm.
And so a lot of them are places where that have pre-industrial economies. Because once you introduce industrialization, lots of those local languages get flushed out, and you have people coming in. The number of languages reduce. That's sort of the thinking.
Right. I mean, the moment you have a city and formalized work, then you need a lingua franca.
Yep. So what they say here, one of their conclusions is that intense biodiversity often correlates to small groups of people with traditional or pre-industrial economies or indigenous languages. Mm. So lots of indigenous languages that aren't spoken by lots of people. And also that loss of language often is accompanied with loss of information about the area as words, culture, and language are gone, and then the flora and fauna go.
Right.
That the presence of language, and even if they're small communities, acts to some degree as a buffer for the flora and fauna
right.
that are there, because they're still, the people are still there.
Right.
So in some ways it's obvious, in some ways it's not so obvious.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool.
That's interesting. And but the languages go first, right?
Yes.
They're the sort of indicator species, as it were.
Well, one of their other conclusions is that conditions that wipe out species wipe out languages too.
So it's not like one doesn't necessarily need to come before the other.
No. So in some ways, they're arguing if you protect wilderness, if you protect areas, you're also protecting the language. If species go extinct, if you're logging and destroying things, eventually you're going to lose the people and you're going to lose the language. So they go hand in hand.
Right.
So in some ways, it's if you want to protect these languages, and I'm sure you can reel off the statistic at the end of the at the end of the 21st century, people expect, almost the majority of languages to be extinct.
Right. One language every two mm-hmm. weeks and all of that. It makes total sense when you think about it. And the sense of both linguistic isolation and geographic isolation
yes.
go hand in hand.
Yep.
And the more isolated, the more the language and nature thrives.
One point in this kind of summary of the study, it said that they don't know why areas of endangered species concentration and endangered languages coexist. And they're only sort of supposing. But that's what they found. They found the correlation. But mm-hmm. they don't exactly know why. They're speculating at this mm-hmm. point. They use global data showing locations that included more than 6,900 languages. And they use, these geographic information systems with Global Mapping International. So they kind of mapped it all out. It's interesting that they basically have the data now, and then they have to figure out why this is. But you can only just suppose. I mean, it may correlate also. I mean, I was just thinking that the not-so-new approach to conservation, species conservation, is getting locals involved in valuing it. So instead of just cordoning off an area and nobody can go there, they're trying to have locals have a financial interest in it,
mm-hmm.
Ecotourism or inns or things like that. So they value the animals. They value the flora and fauna.
Yeah.
So they want to save it. And that's a change from the old way,
yeah,
which is just saying, don't touch it, get away, and we're going to cordon this off and you can't touch it.
Yeah, and I by no means an expert in endangered languages, but it does seem from the little that I've read about it, that there are some correlations there. In other words, if the speakers of the language place a value on that language, and even if there is some financial value to it, which occasionally there can be, then it's a different ball of wax than mm-hmm. if they just simply regard it as an impediment to getting on in life and let's all speak the majority language.
Mm-hmm. Again, a reminder to me of just how many languages there are out there that are spoken by just a handful of people and are just kind of
falling off the cliff.
Yeah. It's just remarkable.
Yeah. Maybe I should just put out this plea right now. I've been talking to a number of people here in the newsroom about doing more stories on endangered languages, and repeat pod listeners will have heard me say this before, but I steer clear of them because I worry about falling into the kind of public radio cliche of
crying in the wind.
Yeah,
it's awful.
All of this kind of stuff. And there's just a way of telling an endangered language story that's deeply dull. And yet it's an extremely dramatic story if one can frame it correctly and do it in a smart audio way. And I still haven't figured that out. But that's one of the sort of larger projects that we're looking at for the future, to just try and figure out ways in which to tell those stories that are memorable.
Yes.
So please let us know if you have any ideas along those lines. I'd really love to, sink my teeth into some of that.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. Instead of hearing the requisite babbling brook, so-and-so sits and fishes for his family every day.
That's right.
He's of the last 50 speakers.
Et cetera. It's, it's tragic, but yet it's dull to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
So
get interesting, Indigenous people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Start a blog. Communicate with Tori Spelling.
Yeah. Get some hobbies going.
Use quotation marks in a funny way.
Speak more Chinglish. Oh, dear. I think that just about wraps it up.
Okay.
It was great to have you back, Carol. Thank you very much. Tell us what's going on in the world of cartoons.
Oh, boy. Lots on Syria. Lots on Russia being complicit. One of the funniest ones I saw was, this is out of nowhere, but I'll just tell you anyway. Russia has a new anti-protester crowd disperser. They've suited up an armored vehicle to shoot out badminton shuttlecocks, you know, the badminton birdies.
Oh, right, at the birdies,
at
yeah.
Protesters.
Yeah.
At a high speed.
Are they like steel-tipped or something?
No, they just go really fast.
It's just medieval.
I know. So there's cartoons of, you know, Russian protesters being hit by birdies.
Oof.
So, like, ooh, okay.
Wow.
So that's where we are.
That sounds certainly worth taking a look at for
oh,
a
yes.
visual. Thanks very much, and hope we do this again before too long.
I do too. Thanks, Patrick.
Cartoon queen Carol Hills. Check out her global political cartoons page at theworld.org/cartoons. And for links to all of the stories and posts that we talked about today, and for a minute-by-minute commentary of Tori Spelling's life, go to theworld.org/language. You can post your comments there if you like, or at the World in Words Facebook page, or you can tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. See you next week.